For those, let's see, I guess by the time this comes out, this brand new hot sauce will be in the link in the bio, but this is the brand new Ausfahrt to Hell. That's your bottle there.
I love that.
It's I remember us brainstorming some name ideas together, and that one just seemed to pop with the image. I like the image so much.
I love it. How hard is it?
Actually? It's really not bad. We had different drafts. So the first one came, I guess it was like August or September. It was in September, I think. And the first one, it's the same flavor profile because we wanted to go after the profile of like camp sauce.
Yeah.
But it was too hot. We did the first draft and me and Ify's family and everybody, we tore it up. Like we ate it so fast. Yeah. But Maria is such a good cook. And I remember asking her what her like real honest feedback was. And she's like, for the average consumer, I think this is way too hot. I think the first draft. So that's like, I think on the hot one scale, like from the 1 to 10, I think the first one was like maybe 8 or 7, mm-hmm. which is pretty hot. And this is closer to a 4 to 5. So there's a good little burn, mm-hmm. maybe depending what we have for lunch. I have an open bottle upstairs.
Yeah, I would love to.
Depending what the lunches we can put it onto, but it has a good, like a little residual burn. But it's gone very quickly,
yeah.
And the flavor is so good. It's one of the, I'm overly proud because it's mine, but it's the first sauce in a long time that I like really have tried to put on everything because it just goes so well. Like I put it on, I made like a fried egg breakfast sandwich, mm-hmm. like or in scrambled eggs, mm-hmm. and it goes great with that. I've put it on, I put it on so many different things. Oh, like a shrimp pasta, mm-hmm. like a shrimp dish, even with rice. It goes good on, like a burger. Of course, chicken wings, mm-hmm. Chicken burgers also, beef. And I haven't put it on something yet. Even like those little pizza, like bagel bites.
Yeah.
We made some, and even on that, it just blends so well. And fish sticks. It goes well with fish. So
with what?
With fish dicks. With fish dish. But I've realized now that I just promoed the sauce for the if you guys are listening to this, the sauce should be in the link in the bio by the time this comes out. So
and there's like a small, like it's written scharfe Soße, and I really can't read German anymore. I always have your voice in my head. When I read something like scharfe Soße, I have like Johannes' voice in my head.
Whenever you read, even if you're reading German, it's not even in your own native voice anymore.
No,
it's
destroyed that.
I'm so sorry about that. I am so sorry for ruining German for you, Moritz. Those swallowed R's are also very tough. The Moritz. Anyway, dude, very long-awaited episode. I have been dying to get you on this show to finally, openly, publicly, with full permission, talk about September 5. Enter applause sound effect. guys, people like my mom and you, the two people who listen to this show, will know that I have been dying to talk about this movie and our experiences with it for 2 years, almost 2 years.
Yeah, I think so.
It was like February 23. That I was on set.
Yeah, but you came on before, right? I mean, you were on the table read. You were
right.
There, yeah.
So it was probably like January-ish, 23 or December 22?
Maybe even that, yeah.
So two full years, which is crazy. Because I think, like, when I see the poster here for it, like, I remember, you know, of course, the room and the set and everything, and it feels like it was just 6 months ago or something. Because you've been so attached to it for so long as the writer, do you feel like it was also a short time ago that things got rolling? Or because you've been with it for so much longer than even the cast being done, does it feel like it's just been going on for like years in your head? I guess it has technically.
It has, yeah. I started 2020, like 4 years ago. I started
with 2020 with that story.
I started writing, yeah. So it's a big part of my life now, and it feels like years. But the shooting, I also have the feeling like this just happened. But it's also like 1.5 years ago now.
I see the images, like also the set photos from our phones and stuff, and I can see only in the photo that much time has passed.
Yeah.
I can see it in like my weight change and how, you know, like my hair and everything looks like, oh, that looks like 2 years ago, but it doesn't feel like it.
Yeah.
It just feels so fresh. It's really crazy. Yeah, let's talk. I hope you don't mind repeating a few things we've talked about personally a billion times, but, so for those who don't know, September 5 is this really exciting thriller that my friend Moritz here wrote, and it's turning into quite the Hollywood film. I mean, it's got a huge cast. We'll get into all that. Directed by your friend Tim Fehlbaum, who's also super successful, you know, already got a good chain of like successes kind of director, and executive produced Sean Penn, which is really great. So like pretty early on, this was locked into, you know, have a good running into either at least being a successful film in the box office, but now it's even gone beyond that and is being campaigned for the Oscars. Is that like an overwhelming thought to you still?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when we started writing that, or when the producers Thomas and Philip approached me with Tim, they had a different movie in mind, or we all did, like a multi-perspective thing on that day in 1972. But then during research, we talked to the real Jeffrey Mason, our main character in the movie, and he talked us through his day back then, like his 22 hours. And then we thought, okay, I think that's the movie. We all thought that. And then we wrote that, and then we realized, okay, but now it's like an American movie. It's like with American characters, and
which suits you. I think that makes perfect sense for this to be like your big debut feature film, because you were just as much as I was deeply inspired by American movies.
Absolutely.
Indiana Jones and like your Harrison Ford obsession, and
this is, I mean, but I think we really realized it when we read the script, not when we wrote it. And with that came like a lot of challenges for the producers. And you mentioned Sean Penn. They knew from a project earlier they did with Tim that getting an American cast is really tough as a European production company. Like getting a talent reading the script is really tough. So they thought about that. And the DP, Markus Förderer, who did like Tim's earlier movies, already is like working a lot in LA and in Hollywood, and he did like Red Notice. No, yeah, I think it's called Red.
The one with The Rock. On
yeah,
Netflix.
Yeah. And when he did that, he met John Wildermuth, who's one of the American producers of our movie, and he founded a company with John Palmer and Sean Penn, and then they approached them with that script. And then when they like were allowed to use Sean Penn's name, like in the mail, they got replies pretty early when they sent the script.
Dude, that is so exciting. I mean, it's like part of your brain goes, well, obviously that's just how it works, you know, but then the other part of you is like, but with me?
Yeah, that's exactly the thing. That really is the thing that, and I think I haven't processed it at all. I mean, I'm just coming back now from LA and New York, and I still haven't processed that whole trip.
Yeah.
And that like the reactions of the people, the having interviews as a writer. I mean, that's obviously pretty tough as a writer, having interviews, having them in English is even more tougher, and having them this level.
Yeah.
It's bonkers, I would say.
What kind of, do you have any, well, maybe we should start at the beginning.
Cause I
definitely want to get into all the Hollywood premieres and the celebrities and all the excitement of campaigning for your movie for the Oscars, which is, I can't believe that's coming out of my mouth.
I have
one of my closest feelings. Friends is probably going to win an Oscar. That's
no,
insane.
No. That's a long
probably.
Way. That's a long way. But you have to tell your funny set stories as well later.
Oh yeah. I wanted to make a reminder, because I have some funny things to tell you, and of course your surprise for the very end of the episode. Ooh, for the very end of the episode. Wow. So you guys will have to listen in until we get there. But yeah, I or
they can scroll.
Makes it,
I mean,
makes can... it sound like I'm dragging them through this interview. Just mean like, be excited. Here, the surprise is coming. But yeah, I mean, like, let's go from the very start. So for the simple man out there who does not know what this movie is about, yeah, what is the true story that it's based on? What's the story?
So during the Olympic Games 1972 in Munich, there has been an attack from a terror organization called Black September, and they kept the like 11 Israeli athletes hostage, and in the end of the day, they all died, the hostages. And that, I think most people will know that story because of Steven Spielberg's Munich, who like deals with the aftermath, is it called like that?
Aftermath.
Aftermath, sorry.
No.
Of that event. And there is a very, very good documentary about that called One Day in September, who won an Oscar, I think, in 1999, which is a very good documentary. I recommend that a lot. One Day in September. It's by Kevin MacDonald, a very good filmmaker. But our approach was differently because during research, we kind of found out for ourselves that... this was the first time that an event like that was broadcasted live globally. And it was done by the ABC sports journalists crew.
Right.
Who were at site that day.
They were covering the Olympics as the sports team,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah. And they had to change, or they had to start broadcasting like worldwide breaking news, and that's the story you want to tell, is like how they did it and what questions arised along the way, and
right,
yeah, and that's the approach.
I think that's a super interesting and very original, unique approach to a story that, you know, not everyone maybe remembers or knows that event. Of course, across Europe, everyone remembers this, and you know, I just basically mean some people in the States probably don't know about it, but they are about to more than ever. But it's so interesting to come at it from that angle, because it's kind of, the movie kind of taps into two really interesting historical moments in human history, and they happen at the same time. One being obviously the horrific terror attack itself. Those images are so strong, and it's such a powerful story in itself, and what that means, and the fact that it was in Germany and post Nazi era, and like all that historical sort of complications all at once. That's already one factor enough that's so interesting. And then the second thing, right alongside it, is like such an underdog story of having these like new, you know, these sports journalists that just happen to be there for the Olympics, and they are creating for the first time ever 24-hour broadcast news cycle using those new satellites. Like everything was new, and it was like, you know, I hate to say like right place, right time, but it was sort of just like you have these people who have the right intuition and the right passion to keep things going, to inform the public, to try and make something new. And it, what isn't it still to this day like the most viewed thing ever?
Well, it was at that time, I think. I think it's not until now the most viewed thing, but it was certainly like...
Isn't that over 900 million?
Like, there are some numbers saying, or like some sources talking about that 900 million people worldwide, like, watched the events. But, I mean, it certainly was more than the moon landing back then, which was like a benchmark back then. But the thing is, you know, those sports journalists, and in particular, like Rune Ahlitsch, the head of ABC Sports, they really knew how to do live coverage and how to tell stories live, because they did it in sports for like they were the first who kind of invented stuff. Rune Artis, for example, he used handheld cameras at the sports events. He was always trying to build like a character arc, like a hero's journey of those athletes. He was the guy who kind of invented the instant replay. He was like playing with that new medium, live television. And when he was there that day, he applied all that knowledge and experience on breaking news, which kind of is something we are used to now, but was kind of the first time.
Yeah.
And I would say what makes it timely is that back then those were like journalistic questions, like, can we show something live like this?
Right.
Whose story is it if we show it live?
Right.
Theirs or ours? I mean, those questions were like strictly journalistic questions back then. But now, like our generation, having smartphones, having social media, being more like not only consumers of this media circle, but also like participants.
Mm-hmm.
I think those questions are questions we all have to ask ourselves. So the movie isn't giving you the answers, it's just asking the questions. And I think this is what the kind of movie I like most, if they don't give you clear answers.
They don't tell you how to think.
Yeah.
They just give you the facts as they are and let you figure things out for yourself. Very well said. You've obviously been media trained the last 10 days.
No, not really. I mean, it's super brave that you bring a writer to a microphone. So I'm really struggling here. But yeah.
I think this might be the least threatening interview position you've been in the last 10 days. But yeah, that's basically the angle and the story of the movie. It's really fascinating. It's very well done. A tight 90 minutes, too. I always kind of thought it would be longer, but it doesn't need to be.
No, because when we talked to the real Jeffrey Mason, the producer who was in that control room that day, he told us that it felt like a rush. It really felt like he had no time to think about anything else than to make this happen, to cover it, to make it right. And we wanted to feel like making the audience feel the same way, to be like on the edge of your seat, like nail biting in a rush. And after that, after the credits, you can think about, okay, what happened there? Yeah. How did I feel about it? And this is what he told us, that it wasn't until after those 22 hours when he went back to the hotel that he suddenly realized what was happening there. He made himself a big drink and started crying, because then he wasn't like in his professional function anymore. He was just a human being thinking about what happened.
Yeah.
And getting this rush right, like to the audience, we knew that it needed to be very like tight 90 minutes thriller.
Yeah, I mean, it's perfect that way. Like the flow is excellent. I feel really lucky that I got to see it before it released to the public too, because I was worried for a while I wouldn't be able to, because I just wanted it so bad, you know, just like seeing the hard work that went into it, being able to relive moments that I got to see acted on the monitor in the video village, like next to you and Thomas, and like, oh my God, this is so exciting. So I was really happy I got to see it too. So if anyone from Constantine Film is listening, which I doubt, if you are, thank you very much.
But you put a lot of hard work in there too, because you talk now like you're a journalist talking about the movie. You've been a big part of the movie.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I wanted to start with like a section basically to let people get in on what the whole thing's about. But yeah, the personal stories attached to it are also so important to me. Like, I don't know when that first, what was the first thing that I got? Was it checking the English?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I sent you the script for some expressions and stuff, like, can you please tell me if this is like straight English or it's just German English I wrote there? And then you gave me feedback on that. And then I think I kind of already introduced you to Tim Fehlbaum, the director. And then later when there was a table read for the first time where we tried to, not with the actors, but with native speakers, tried to read, making like a read-through process, does the script work, blah, blah, blah. Tim reminded or like thought of you and brought you in, and you nailed it that day.
Oh, this was at Thomas's office, right?
Yeah.
Was the step I was forgetting. I was like, how did I even once read it for him to bring me into the actual movie job? Because I didn't remember that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember I got dropped off at that office. It was my first time there.
Yeah.
And then immediately thrown into, like, I mean, at first, for sure, pretty intimidating scenario, because you got the, I still don't know Thomas, the producer, that well.
Yeah.
I know him better now. I'm not scared to say hi to him. But that first day, I was like in his office, and I just knew him as this huge producer, and you were there. But throughout this whole process, you know, understandably, you were super locked in. You had your same as that day, as the last day I saw you on set. You got a big job to do. So it's, I also couldn't like lean on you so much, because I was like, no, I can't bother him either. I don't want to say. And then there's the director, and he's very kind, but he's the director of a feature. I got to like do my job. And I remember that being kind of nerve wracking. But then like the saving grace, the lucky, like that's really right place, right time. The luckiest thing ever is that just by some chance, whoever the guy was reading the blocking, for those who don't, blocking is the text that's telling you where the people are in the room, like he opens the door or he sits down, whatever. The guy reading the blocking just, for some reason, maybe it's not even how he normally talks, but he just stumbled over himself a bit too much. And it kept slowing down the energy of the read. You know, you were losing the speed of like the rush of a moment. And I don't know who stopped it. I don't know if Tim stopped it or if Thomas stopped it. But someone was like, we need to change something. And I didn't raise my hand or anything. I think Tim just looked at me and said, can you do that? And I was like, yeah, sure, no problem. And inside my body, I was like, yes. Because I knew I could do it. I knew I could do it. Like, I can speed read loud, like, vocally quite well. And it was just this lucky chance to sit there. And then all of a sudden I could read all of your words out loud, like read the whole movie in one big go through. Cause I think before I just had sections, so I didn't know how things connected.
I think before that you read out some dialogues, but the thing is that, I mean, that's your understatement, but you really nailed it, because you read the blocking like a character. You really, while reading it, you sensed, okay, this is the mood of the scene, or this is like the topic of the scene, or what the scene wants, and you read the blocking like that. So
right.
Everybody got in the mood of, okay, this is going to be our movie. And I think that was a very crucial moment for us as screenwriters. Like Tim and I wrote that, and Alex David later joined us in helping us with the American approach, mm-hmm. the character arcs, the language. He was there too, and
right.
We suddenly all had for the first time a real feeling for our script, and say, okay, hearing it like that,
yeah,
like you read it
like a teleplay,
yeah, it really, so cool. It was like, okay, it makes sense now. And I think the way you did that did get you the gig later at the set.
Sure. I'm very happy that I could just lock in and kind of forget the nervousness and just do it. I had a lot of fun reading it like that too. And again, later at the big table read with Peter Sarsgaard sitting next to me, like, how am I not exploding right now? and that main room read though, yeah, it was so much fun to get into a point where obviously this is something tragic, or like there's a moment of shock, and to take that pause, to take that breath, and like feel the weight of the room, and then back into something energetic. And yeah, I'm happy that I could do it when I needed to do it, because otherwise I probably wouldn't have been asked to do the job. And I remember, like, I think you had mentioned that Tim was considering me for the job first before he called me. But we weren't sure exactly, and I had a trip to the States planned, like, exactly during the filming, and we pushed everything. Like, as soon as Tim called, I was like, oh, man, this is like a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Like, to not only to be there to support you on this big movie at Bavaria Studios, which is just like a kid's dream, both of our kids' dreams to be on this big lot, you know? But also to meet like an actor who I've admired since I was like 15, you know, to meet John and Leonie and Ben as well. But Peter for me was just like, oh my God, I've been such a fan, you know, for like so long. But, Yeah, that brought me into the job. We pushed the vacation. We made all the agreements with the contracts. And then, yeah, when everything was signed and set up, then we had that big table read in Bavaria Studios at, I guess, Thomas's production office?
I think so, yeah. That was a production office, yeah.
And then we had the... oh, yeah, that's funny because it was day one of the job. Day one. And I go in, I meet Peter, I'm so excited, I'm like so flustered with, you know, I'm like trying to not talk to him too much, but I'm so nervous. And I'm seated like pretty much next to him, or maybe later I moved down one seat, but I was like me and then a chair, then him. You were there and Tim, of course, a few other people, assistants buzzing around, and then this big screen with all the other actors trying to do like a Zoom run through. I think John McGarrow was in like a hotel.
Yeah, he had COVID.
He had COVID.
Right before the shooting, yeah.
And that was also kind of funny. And yeah, it was kind of a mishmash. And that was so exciting and so fun. Everything went great. And then I was so excited for day two. And at 3 a.m., the night between day one and day two, I woke up with the most unforgiving, explosive diarrhea. If I was on the Oregon Trail, I would have died. Like, I would not have been hydrated enough to live. I wouldn't have made it.
Man, I was so sorry for you when you wrote me that text. I was so... I think, surely it was just adrenaline or something. I don't know.
But... I don't know. I mean, if he didn't feel sick, I don't know what if we just... Yeah, maybe it was just the combination of just, like, stomach stress. But it was just... And I was up. I was, like, pretty much up from 3 to... I think I was supposed to wake up at 6:30. But I was up pretty much from 3 to 6:30, and but I was like, I can't cancel. I'm not gonna not go, you know. And I remember, I texted you that you have to help me figure out some excuse to be a little late. And you were so kind as to tell them, I don't even know if anyone asked, but that you had a prepared excuse of that the taxi driver was taking me to the different.
To the wrong studios.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was... I didn't have to use the excuse, but I had it already prepared in my pocket that, that your driver drove you to the wrong studio, so you're like going to be a half an hour late.
Oh,
but so you were just on time.
Yeah, just
and pretty pale, I have to say.
Dude, I was pale. I was so sweaty and with in my stomach dying. And I remember like we were going to do the second read-through, and I'm literally... I have like 3 minutes... before I have to be in that room, settled and going, and I'm shitting my brains out. It's just water, and I'm sitting there in this professional production office on a major movie set, and I'm like, please, God, stop. And I had gone to the pharmacy, and I had no energy in my, I had nothing in me to have more manners. You know, I couldn't be like, do you have this medicine? I was like, I have Durchfall. I was like, I have diarrhea, please help me.
Like a 5-year-old. Poor you, man.
I never wished more in my life to have Pepto-Bismol, that pink liquid, because it just soothes everything. But they don't have it here, so I had to take the Imodium pills. I think I took like 11 in one big handful. Like, make it stop. And somehow we got through it with me just like wiping my forehead and drinking tiny sips of water. We got through it. And I remember like we had a lunch break,
mm-hmm.
and I stood outside with you by that bench, by mm-hmm. that door. And you were like, how are you, buddy? I was like, well, I haven't had to go in a little while. I can't wait till they send me home. The whole day, it just felt like I barely ate anything. But then it was over. Then, thank God, it didn't happen the next day.
But nobody could tell. You really did it. I mean, I think we have to explain what your job was. Because,
yeah.
Because in that whole story, in the script, there are just basically, there's an ensemble in that room that day, in the control room and the studio lot. And there is a lot of phone calls coming in, a lot of walkie-talkie. People talking about walkie-talkies. There's a lot of footage coming in, and there is obviously that live reporter Jim McKay sitting in the studio talking to the people, and some of those parts and a lot of like voices that came in that day you had to do live.
Right.
While shooting, so the actors could react to something, and the actors could act with somebody
right.
On the phone or on the walkie-talkie, which was a pretty impressive and tough job, because when people watch the movie, they see how much voices and dialogue lines are coming in via phone and walkie-talkie.
Exactly, yeah.
So, and there's a very crucial scenes where Peter Sarsgaard's character, Rune Ahlitsch, is on the phone, like shouting to somebody or discussing something, and he had to have a counterpart, yeah. And that was you.
Dude, I mean, that I remember, yeah, the biggest acting scene, I still vividly remember it sitting on that fake hotel bed. I mean, and you had to come in once and be like, tone it down a little bit. I was like, oh no, I'm going to get fired. But I remember that because it felt like minutes in my head, but like a pretty long scene with me, just me on a phone with him.
Yeah.
Which is like, you can't ask for anything more cool than that. But the job, besides being rewarding for moments like that, like also doing it with John, like, cause I didn't know him as well, but then getting to like feel that character, like he was really, really extremely convincing. Like John McGraw is great in this movie. And we'll get into all that because also I have to talk about Ben Chaplin, but, the trickiest stuff came later. I think probably just the week before my last day, there was, and this happened a few times, you'll remember, where like I had the sides for that day, like the scenes we were going to shoot. And then they would bring me like 3 walkie-talkies.
Mm.
And they would be like, in this scene, they're watching, you know, Jim McKay discuss what's going on. And they need to have that break of like long enough of what he's saying. And they said, okay, you know, walkie-talkie A is Jim McKay. You're going to say that. And then they'd get a phone call from Peter Jennings. So then Peter, from wherever office he was at, would call. So then that's walkie number 3. And then they would have, I don't know if it was Leonie Benish or maybe it was someone else, like the... who was the guy? Who was the runner?
Yeah, yeah. You had like, I mean, like they're like, you have to say that in the control room, they have to talk like to the tower cam. They have to talk like to cam 1, to cam 2. They have Peter Jennings on the phone. They have the runner, Gary, on a walkie. So there were scenes where it had to be like 4 or 5 different characters coming from 4 or 5 different sources because they had to react in that room and they had to turn their heads to a phone and then to a walkie and then to the screen. So that was not only you saying those lines, you had to tell the lines into the right walkie at the right time. So that was a very...
That was some tricky...
Tricky job.
Yeah. And sometimes it was because of just the... one-way communication process of it because I was in a, like, not in a box, but like I was quite separated from the actual shooting set just so the sound didn't cross over. And there was a few times where I didn't know that they had cut early. Like maybe there was like a technical mistake and I just kept going. And then one of those Kai or one of the other poor PAs was like sprinting over like, Jordan, they've cut. I was there like full in, like they've killed all of the hostages. You know? It was so funny. But there was some great moments on that set, dude. Like what a fantastic job, like a job to have. Like just be, even the days where like, I think the first like 3 or 4 days I wasn't even needed, but that was cool because I just got to watch. I was in full costume every day, head to toe, full costume, greasy. What I don't miss is the greasy, oily, super long hair and the long mustache. I couldn't cut
any
of that.
I liked you. I mean, I think it...
There's a cool picture of you. Yeah. I think when I'm like pulling up the pants from the back a little bit, that does look kind of cool. I was skinnier, dude. I should really lose my weight again. But I sometimes it looked kind of cool. You can tell in the trailer. They did a good job. I look like I'm from the time.
Yeah.
You know, I really there's three major scenes where I feel like it's very clear I'm in the background, and then in the trailer I pop up 2 little short times. But in the still frames that I obsessed over, obviously. I was, my friend Todd and my mom also was like, no, you really, they did a great, you look, you don't stand out as like a modern guy in an old movie. No.
And they didn't aim for the ridiculous 70s. I mean, it's not like.
It's just like brown business 70s.
Yeah, it's like more they said, okay, in the 70s, especially 72, like the beginning 70s, not everybody looked like the 70s. They looked maybe more like the 60s. Some old fashioned guys, maybe like. A little bit like the 50s, so it's
right.
It's a very, I think you can tell by the costumes, it's very authentic and you're,
yeah.
I mean yours too and your makeup, you really look, you don't look like one of those like the 70s show or something. You really look like a real person, like a time traveler in a way.
Yeah, I was really, I was insecure about it the first day or so, but then when I would catch myself or when someone would talk about it, my confidence grew and I started to like the costume. I started to like that guy. But yeah, that job that I guess the main one that I was doing talking offset, that I guess they off speaker was the official title.
I think so.
But they kind of created the job, right?
I never heard of that job before. I think they created it. And I think you're credited.
Yes, I'm credited like as off speaker with someone else. I don't know who the other one was.
When you left for your trip to the USA, somebody did it for a couple of days. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I loved that. And just out of the, maybe because Tim could tell that I was quite hungry for attention, because that's, I mean, hello, or purely out of the kindness of his heart, he also gave me, like we're saying, a job as a background actor. And that was just so special.
But you did great. I mean,
you know, the
it point helps is the movie a lot.
Yeah. I mean, the point is to be in a spot and not stand out and just, you know, and like be as natural as you can be. Not look at the camera.
No, but you have to say, I mean, that when you do like a movie that's basically shot in one room or like a couple of rooms, it's a very different job than being an extra on a street scene or like a big shot or like a battleground or whatever.
True. Yeah.
We needed people. Like actors, for the smaller parts and extras who really could do it because they were a very crucial part of that room experience. So I think it's not just you being like hungry for attention and being put in the background. I think Tim really saw something in you. Otherwise, he wouldn't have used you because it's a very, very crucial part for that movie, all the people in the room.
You're very flattering.
No, I'm just honest.
I mean, that is actually a really good... I would have thought, as usual, that you're just flattering me to flatter. But that is a very good note about the fact that it is a battleground scene where you're just, like, noise. It is a small, compact place. So I'm very... For every second that I'm on that screen, I'm very grateful for that to you, especially also to Tim, like, for him to say that that's what he wants. That means a lot. And he's so kind and funny. You know, and he's so professional, and you can immediately read him like, okay, I'm going to stay completely out of his way, not because he would be a dick, but because you don't want to disturb what he's thinking about. And then other times where you can read his shoulders a bit where he's approachable to ask a question or to make a joke or something. And, you know, he was very rarely, maybe never unapproachable. I think, you know, I mean, no, you can tell when he's got a lot going on, so you stay out of the way. But, if I caught him in a moment of like a coffee and I just wanted to ask how he's doing or something, he was never like, maybe not right now. You know,
he's not that kind of director who goes to the video village or the trailer.
He's very hands-on.
He's hands-on. Sometimes he has the camera on his shoulder, operating one of the cameras. Like he's very in the scene, in the moment, next to the actors. And the approach to that movie was like, and you can tell better than me, I think, the experience, because there wasn't really like, how you call it? I mean, there wasn't like really a behind the scenes, because the studio lot of the ABC was really fitting into the studio lot of the Bavaria studios. Julian Wagner, the production designer, he designed the whole studio lot of ABC in the studio, and every room was 360 degrees set, and it really felt like being in the studios in the 70s. So we were all more like on location than being in a studio set.
Absolutely. If you didn't look directly above your head, you'd never know that you're in a film studio. Like, and it's so impressive, like everything, like, except for the exterior stuff that they did in a special location, like with the B team, everything inside is a completely functional, active set. I mean, especially you see the main room here on the poster, that main switchboard room, those screens were all active, and you know, the buttons they're pressing aren't necessarily the ones controlling them, but everything functioned, everything was working, the headsets are legitimate, you know, everything was so perfectly put together. And like there's scenes where people are coming into the office or rushing down the hallway to make a phone call. And that whole hallway was really there connecting out of the studio, going down to Rune's office. Like everything was all actually functional and working as a small studio, you know?
And it was pretty hard. I mean, because there is a lot of technology involved, obviously. And there were like a moment where Julian, the production designer, told Tim, so I think basically everything that's working, like every equipment piece in Europe, is now here in the set. Because Tim really wanted machinery and equipment that works, that the actors could really interact with.
Yeah.
So some things were out of museums, and there were like people from the museum standing next to the thing, making sure that we don't like damage it. And,
sure.
And
I didn't even know that.
That was really crazy. There was like, and there was like a crazy collector in Germany who had like a basement full of technical stuff, and they really had to scrub it and clean it to make it look like it's state of the art and not like 50 years old. And and then the cameras moved around in that set almost like a pretty annoying documentary team. So every scene was like from the beginning to the end. There were never like real pickups.
Right,
like
right.
Just parts of the scene. It was always from the beginning to the end and the cameras moving around.
Right.
So the whole thing and you like as the off speaker, everything was meant to really be in that room for the actors to have something to act with. Like feeling being there and not just like having a close up on him or her, like doing the whole scene over and over again from different angles. And when, I mean, I was like most of the time I've been on set and it really felt like entering a time capsule or something, like really being in that studio. That was a crazy experience. And you were in the costume. Everybody was like,
yeah, dude,
it was really like a time traveling.
Like it really was like time traveling. I think, but also, what made it special is that no matter what, even if you didn't shoot a lick that day, you're in costume.
Yeah.
Everyone who's like potential cast, you know? I mean, there was full on off speaker days where I was just like head to toe costume and they never brought me on. So it was so funny for me to like see also so many other extras and like featured extras all the way up to the main cast. And there's just like that main door to the hallway, to the magic world. And you just open it and you can immediately tell. Like you have like, you know, you and Thomas and Tim and Marcus, and then you look over and there's like 30 people from 1972. And it's so magical. It's like that feeling of, oh, we're making movies, baby, you know. And I can't recall a single person that wasn't extremely at least kind or easy to talk to in some way. Like there was not. I don't remember. I don't think there was one person that I was like, ugh, that guy.
No, it was that the team was extraordinary. I have to say that too. And even like also in quality, I think there were like people there I always wanted to meet because they're like top notch in Germany, like from the best boy who like doing the lights to everybody, like costume, obviously Julian who did all the production design. Every department was like top. It was like
the best.
It was crazy to see
the makeup ladies,
how they worked. I mean, yeah, you met the makeup ladies. They really helped you once, right? When you were like waiting to be on screen, and then something happened, and they had to help you.
Oh no, that was Sophie. That was costume.
Oh, costume. Yeah.
Yes, poor Sophie. Okay, funny story. You probably know that's P, right? You know that's pee, right? Yeah. I always said it was water, but I finally wanted to tell this to everyone. Knows it smells like pee. Of course. Dude, it was the worst moment ever. And I'm going to own it because it's a funny story and time has moved on. It's been 2 years. But it was like such an it was like I could tell that story and look in your eyes and know that you knew. But you were too kind to be like, dude, you know? Okay, so here's what happened. I'm having one of those days where I'm not used much and or I'm off speaking, but I have a huge gap where I'm not needed. But I'm in costume, right? A full day costume. It's always a gamble to spill food or whatever, you know. So it's, thank God it's, I'm towards the end of my job. I think it's just like 4 more days or something. It's not much because, I mean, it would have been horrible to have gone the entire shoot like this. But what happens is I'm peeing standing up in the staff bathroom, or in the toilet at the production. I'm peeing standing up, and because of some horrible curse of God, I don't know if this is maybe a little TMI for some people, but this happens very often with men. But sometimes when you're finished and everything goes back where it's supposed to go, sometimes there's a little dribble, just a touch. And you can try and shake everything out, but sometimes it still just happens. And the most horrible thing ever happened, where I was putting things back, and for some reason, a little, like, just a spurt came out at the worst time. And I'm wearing extremely, like, this woolen fabric pants, which if you put a drop of water on it, it is, like, dark. Like, black. Like, it's so black, obvious. And it takes forever for it to dry off. My initial instinct was like, oh my God, this is so horrible. But thankfully, I'm not really needed today. So I am freaking out in the bathroom. I have gone into a stall. I have taken the pants off, and I'm wafting them in like, whenever someone comes in, I just kind of like blow on it. And when someone leaves, I'm wafting them, like, please, because I can't. You know, I was like, it's sunny outside, but I can't walk out there holding wet pants, and everyone's going to know. And so, of course, exactly in that moment, Kai, one of the PAs, comes in there and is like, Jordan, are you in there? And I went, no, please, God, not now. And I was like, yeah. And he said, you're needed on set. You're needed in the background. And then I tried to hide it. With my jacket.
With your jacket.
I came up and I like sprinted over to my chair in the back part. I took my jacket and wrapped it around my waist and kind of turned it a little bit. And I was like, well, you know, if I'm just like in this corner spot, maybe they won't care, because I was just seen from the chest up usually at that back table. I was like, maybe they won't care. I can just tell them I'm a little cold. And dude, I go up and I forgot the AD's name, the woman.
Uli,
yeah. She was great. She comes up and she's cool, but she's all business. So yeah. She's like, what are you doing? Take it off. Come on, sit down. Like, we got to go. And I kind of tried to pretend I didn't hear her. And I was like, oh, here at this seat. And so like, and I sat down.
Such a good strategy.
And I sat down. I kind of just ignored the take off the jacket part. I was like, if I just sit down and I scoot up under the table, maybe she won't even notice that I didn't take it off, because you can't see it on camera. And I can just say, oh, but my legs are cold, whatever. You know, I'm thinking of anything to just, like, maybe a bomb will hit. Maybe we'll all die. Wouldn't that be great? Then we never have to talk about this. And of course, she doesn't waste a moment. You know, she comes, she's like, take it off. What are you doing? And dude, then in front of the guys who are doing, like, taking the footage and storing it, like that back camera guys. I forgot what that job's called. But like, from the storage guys and in front of Oli and like, two other extras and the girl who was, I don't know, like running the sound thing, backspace. Mm-hmm. It was like 5 people. I had to, and also straight up lie, and it being so ridiculously obvious that I've lied. I told them, I was like, I was drinking a water bottle and I spilled the whole thing down my pants and I look ridiculous. My pants are soaked. And then Uli was like, well, why don't worry about it. Like, why would you, don't lie about it. Like, we'll just go get it fixed. And then I was like, well, in my mind, I was like, can I just go like outside? Can I just not be in this scene? Like, cause now that I've watched it, you never see me in that booth. And that's where I sat most of the time. I'm like, I know they don't see me here. Like, can I please just go jump into traffic or something? And they get Sophia, who is this, first off, super cool young girl. Pretty and super, like, she dresses hip. She's like got this Berlin thing. She's chatty. She's sociable, like a very, like, an attractive person. She's the costume person who they bring over to come have me stick out my pant leg and blow dry my pee soaked. And it's like, guys, it's into my sock. Like, some, I don't, it wasn't even that much, but it just like soaked. And it was just the whole leg, man. The whole leg. And I was, and it was so obvious. She's blow drying my pee leg, and the smell is everywhere. It's so, and she says nothing, and you say nothing, and no one says anything. And it was the most embarrassing day of my life. It was the most embarrassing day. I'll never, the good news is I'll never have anything more embarrassing than that story. And it was so kind that no one was like, you peed yourself a little bit. Like, no one said a word, dude. And I left that day. I was like, everyone knows. But no one's gonna, everyone knows, but maybe everyone will just forget. And I was like, well, at least at the end of the shooting day, no one brought it up, you know, like no one was like, come on, man, we know, you know. And I, like, and the big problem, and this is the big issue too, is that I don't know why they weren't allowed to do this, but they couldn't wash any of the clothes for the entire shoot, which also seems like a big mistake, especially for pants. Like, dudes are farting all day and all, and like, just wash the pants. And I was like, maybe they'll wash the pants now. And they didn't. She blew dry the pants where I could at least do the job, reeking of piss. And then the first break we have, thank God it's a sunny day, I go out on the staircase under that door in front of the makeup people. Dude, I sit there wide-legged, staring at the sun, face and hands like, maybe lightning will strike me. Like, maybe I'll have a heart attack or something. Like, this is so... And I just had everything dry out as much as possible. And then I stood outside as much as I could the rest of that day. Like, if I wasn't needed, I was outside because it was, like, a little windy. And I thought, maybe, like, just maybe it will... The smell will fade a bit or something, you know? And I think I even... put some cologne over it just to try. And I think I had like fantasies that where I was like, before I got busted, obviously, I was like, maybe I could wear my jacket around my waist, because I had parked where I shouldn't. I parked pretty close to the door. I was like, maybe I can put the jacket around my waist, then go to my car, take the pants off and put it in front of the AC and blast the AC or the air. Maybe I could drive around and like have them hang out the window. Like, I was thinking,
imagine that.
I was thinking of every, and then they're like, Jordan, we need you. Like, pants flying. Oh. I'm so glad that's off my chest now.
Oh man. Poor
it's
you.
So embarrassing. Poor dude. You. That was the worst day. That was, and I mean, and you're there with like Peter Sarsgaard's there, you know, like, fuck. Oh my God. I put an asterisk. I was like, water spill. Like, make sure to tell the story. Cause I had told Efi too, I was like, I'm telling the story when I have Mortz on the show. I have to own it. It's just so funny. Cause obviously it's an accident, but it's like, why was I needed exactly? I wasn't needed for like 6 hours.
Yeah.
And then, like, at the sixth hour, I piss my leg, and they're like, we need you.
It's always like that, right?
Yeah. God. And I was like, I was like, are they going to put me in the main room? Is this my wish coming true where I'm in the main room with these guys? And I was like, imagine now I have to go in there, and, like, someone's like, is that you? No. okay. Now I've owned it. Now it's there. Besides that, though... The rest of the whole filming time was awesome. Like, even the you had to leave before I was done, right? Why did you have to leave early again?
I had to. I think
you left before Peter was even done. He was done before me.
Yeah, what was that? I think that was a different job. I had like a deadline on another script or something,
like a Tatort or something, or
yeah, something. And I had to skip 1 week. Earlier, I think it
that's
to,
right.
Yeah,
because you were out before Peter was gone.
Yeah,
Peter was gone. I think like 3 days before me or 4 days before me.
Maybe. And then I went back. But then already Peter was wrapped, and you were like sitting in a plane to the U.S. Yeah,
right. Yeah. Oh, the other cast. I would be remiss to not talk about some of these supporting actors here.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to look at the names here because let me pull up here on the IMDb. Man, but when Peter cuts his hair short, he looks so nice. Yeah, there's a few supporters here that I just adore. Like Corey Johnson.
Yeah.
Dude. Marcus Rutherford, that was the guy I was thinking of for Carter. Corey Johnson, for those who don't know, he's from New Orleans, and he absolutely freaked out when he found out that I had come from New Orleans.
Really?
He was so friendly. He had the most excited conversation with me. He's a real like American New Orleanian son of a gun. You know, he's like, you guys should look him up because he, yeah, he was born May 61 in New Orleans. I know him best from being like a supporting role in The Mummy.
Mm-hmm.
He was in Morbius and the Mauritanian also. He was and in Captain a Phillips.
Lot,
wow.
A lot,
oh,
a lot.
United 93. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a working actor.
Yeah.
He is a very, very busy man. It seems like he's done like boatloads of TV and movies and stuff for years. So he's the kind of actor that like, I would love to be that kind of actor because he can still, you know, he's not like, a Gyllenhaal or like a Margot Robbie where he like can't literally do anything without having all these people to help him. He could still definitely go to a grocery store or go do whatever he wants. Maybe one or two people would be like, hey, you're that guy from that thing. And he's making a living.
Yeah.
He's making a good, I mean, he's busy.
And he's working with really great directors. I mean,
right.
He's in great movies. Like Paul Greengrass, United 93 and stuff. That's pretty
right.
cool.
I always forget about Captain Phillips right there with Tom Hanks, man. Yeah. That's huge. Yeah, I feel a little ashamed now that I didn't mention that when I saw him because, of course, all I asked him about was The Mummy.
Yeah.
But he was so happy about it. He was like, oh, what an experience. That was a hell of a time, brother. That was you know, GD. He was just such a, like, American, hey, rootin' tootin', pew, pew. You gotta love it. And then this Jacques, I cannot probably say his name.
Zinedine Soualem. Yeah. He was... Man, he looks so great. Yeah, when you watch the movie,
yeah,
like on the big screen, that's unbelievable.
He has the perfect look.
Yeah,
I guess he's in a bunch of French movies.
Yeah,
How did you guys find him? Did he audition?
I don't know. How did Tim find him? I think there were like a couple of casting directors, and I think somebody brought him up, but I know that Tim was intrigued like instantly when he saw him, and I didn't see most of the supporting actors until Tim shot a screen test. Like he put them already in like in parts of the set in costume, and just like did some walks with them, shooting the walks. And when I saw Corey and Zinedine, they really looked like people from 1972.
100%.
The energy they had, like, unbelievable. It's so great to have them in the movie.
They're perfect choices. And my favorite supporting role to talk to when we were just sipping coffee in the background was Benjamin Walker, dude.
Benjamin Walker, yeah.
That guy, talk about, like, I think I even said this to his face, or I know I said it to you when I met him. I was like, this is like the most all-star, all-American, like football American looking dude like ever. He looks like he was a famous quarterback.
Yeah.
For, you know, like the Patriots or something. He's from Georgia. And he was the funniest, nicest dude. He doesn't even look like himself here, and he's in the Rings of Power show.
Yeah, he's playing this Elfin King in the Rings of Power. Yeah,
it's crazy. What a big budget show to be doing.
Yeah.
And he was also Abraham Lincoln Vampire Killer. I love that. But I was trying to think of exactly what I remember him from so well, because his face, like, I know him so well. Maybe it's from a TV show, because I know he did a lot of TV as well. I don't know if I'll find it now, but I know him. Oh, Kinsey, of course. Yeah, Kinsey, right. That's Sarsgaard's also in Kinsey, too. They worked together in Kinsey, right. Anyway, not to just go through random actors' IMDb's, but Benjamin Walker, man, what a cool guy.
And he had to do a hard job because he's playing Peter Jennings, and Peter Jennings is, I think, in the generation of your parents, like a very famous anchorman in the US, right?
He's
the news guy. Everybody knows the way he looks, the way he talks.
Yeah.
And he really had to own that character, and he did such a great job.
Yeah.
Like doing Peter Jennings on-air personality and voice, and then providing something how he would be like off air.
Yeah.
That's a pretty, that was a very tough job, and he did that really great.
Do you know where he recorded his just isolated audio? Did he do that on set somewhere, or did he do it from a different...
I think he did it from London.
From London. Yeah, he was really cool. The funny behind-the-scenes story about Benjamin Walker. There's a scene in the movie, I think in the final cut, it's just a glimpse, so it's not really... Because I was cutting back and forth to him as like a PA. Basically, the scene that we did a few times was... He was there next to the guy playing Jim McKay, and I would come up pretending to have like a note or something like, hey, excuse me, blah, 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 the lighting of this, or do you have an appointment after this? And then go back off camera. So I would pop in, lean over his shoulder, pretend to tell him something. He'd nod his head, and then I'd go back. And we did it like 4 or 5 times. In the end, I don't even know if they kept that. But he, every time I came up to him, he said something different to me that was absolutely hilarious. Like he wanted me to break. And one time I really, man, it was so hard to stay to stay smiling and to not break. There was one thing, I don't know what he said once. He had like the cigarette and the makeup cloth around his thing, like for the scene. And I would run over and be like, Mr. Jennings, you have an appointment at 3:00. And he would go, hey, who's that girl running the camera over there? And I'd go, I don't know who goes, get her number for me. But in character, like as a joke, you know? And every time I came back, it was a completely, he would say something different every time. He was great. Let's see
he
if
was
I,
great, yeah.
When editing, what a name. Hans-Jörg Weisbrich.
Yeah, he's probably the best editor we have in Germany.
What a name. Wow.
For you, that's a very German name.
Hans-Jörg, that sounds like Swedish almost. And Weisbrich.
Yeah, but I mean, talking about editing, I have to say that a lot of that experience...
Unorthodox.
He did a lot. He's really one of the really best editors we have in that nation.
That's country. Awesome, dude.
And talking about that experience, like this nail biting, sitting the edge of your seat, obviously I would say there's a lot of that in the script, but no, seriously, he did such a great job with Tim together in editing that because there's really a lot of things that are not in the movie or that are like in a different rhythm, like written in a different rhythm and then edited like to that point that it's that experience. So
yeah.
The editing of that movie is a very big part of its success, I would say. And Hans-Jörg, he's the best.
He definitely matched the pacing. Yeah. Like the story. Yeah, like you said, like it's on the page, but a good editor knows that and finds it. And he definitely, everything is just so seamless. There's no fat left to cut. Yeah. It's really like the purest. Every scene is just how it's supposed to be.
And you have to say that, I mean, yeah, it's on the page, but then the way Tim shot the movie was like with two cameras always moving around like a documentary, so there were like a ton of material, like a lot of material, and finding those gems in the whole material and making it so tight, that's really unbelievable what Hans-Jörg did there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's really, I was very blown away by that. There's a few things that I wasn't sure how they even did it, because it's working on the set and then seeing how they move around in within the set on film. Yeah. And there's doors they open. Obviously, that's not those doors.
Yeah.
There's two things. Maybe you can quickly explain them if you know how they were done. And then I want to go into your press tour because it was so exciting that you went to Hollywood. But the two things are, one, when John Magaro opens those doors and sees Marcus and the other guy moving the camera.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's not that door. Yeah. How did they blend that?
I think that's...
just a different shot and they...
That shot, I think, was shot in the Olympic Village and then they just did a simple screen.
Oh, yeah, because I wasn't sure if they... Oh, that makes... so much sense because I remember them putting an enormous screen in front of that door. Duh. And then the other one, I guess, is probably the same thing where it's night and Peter runs out and it's one fluid thing where he looks up and sees the helicopter passing. I guess that wasn't real time, right? No.
No. Well, this is something I have to ask Marcus myself, the DP, because Marcus he's very hands-on and he loves to do in-camera tricks. So I know that a lot of the helicopter stuff is actually like a miniature helicopter that he found. But I don't know if the miniature helicopter is in that shot or if this is just the one VFX or CGI helicopter we had. But I really, I don't know.
It looks super good. Yeah. I mean, because again, it's not, that's not what you see when you come out of that door.
Yeah.
So everything had to kind of be just perfectly yeah. stitched. And then, but it still feels like one, you know, it's not like with Megaro where you stay inside looking out.
Yeah.
With Peter, the camera goes out.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
that's really cool.
That's true. But this is what I really love about the movie, that everything feels so analog and not that much CGI and stuff. It's really...
Yeah. You would never know that there was any CGI at all. It's very in the grain, the grit,
yeah.
you know, the smoky air. I mean, the team just did such a great job. So the movie is amazing. I'm very, very happy with it. And I'm really, really happy for you. Let's talk about going to Hollywood, man. Like,
yeah.
so the film, how does it start with the film gets this buzz and gets like, what's the starting process for that?
Well, we were super lucky to have a premiere at the Venice Film Festival. We were like in a side section there. But it did really well.
Mm-hmm.
The first reviews, I mean, when the movie is running for half an hour, then the reviews are allowed to go out. So when the credits rolled, like at the premiere, John Palmer, the producer, gave me his phone and just flicked through some headlines and they were all great.
Oh, that's awesome.
And that was such a relief. Like, wow, okay.
You see reviews as soon as you come out.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable, dude.
And then... they had to Telluride, like, because the Telluride was the North American premiere, and this festival changed everything in a way because it was so well received there, and there were like a couple of really important journalists sitting there, like Scott Feinberg saw that there too, Clayton Davis from Variety. So there were pretty important journalists loving the movie and championing for it and like writing great reviews. And from that moment on, Paramount thought, okay, we always believed in that movie, but maybe it's like an Oscar contender. Maybe this is something the journalists love and the audience will love, to that point that it might be an awards contender. So the Telluride thing really created that momentum, I would say.
That's amazing. So, okay, so it really was, oh, there's Saoirse Ronan. There's so many cool, just seeing the celebrities that attend the festival.
Everybody, here. I mean, I think I wasn't there, but everybody who went there said, this is the greatest festival because there's almost no press. There's just the filmmakers in this mountain village, like
it's
watching cool. their movies, like showing the movies, watching them, and the audience was, I mean, this is just like from Philip telling me and Tim, was so engaged. The audience was so engaged that was really, I think, a magical moment for everybody who was there.
Dude, I'm so impressed with September 5. Yeah, I'm so impressed with the run that this movie is on right now, and it's cool. Like, it's cool to also see that process where, you know, Paramount isn't necessarily from the start like angling it as a type of contender, but allows the festivals to kind of speak for themselves, let the reviews speak, and then they are smart enough to say, now we should maybe put our money and our effort into it.
I mean, Paramount always believed in that movie.
Right.
And
right.
they but it's not a big movie, you know. It's like it's not,
like they know it's very good,
I think it's with every movie that way, but there are some kind of certain movies that are like, I think, already made to be awards contenders, you know, like already written like awards contenders, and we're somehow more like an underdog story because we found that story, we loved it, we tried to make it like work and happen, and then it turned out great and the reviews were great, and then Paramount said, okay, I mean, everything is looking good. It's like a dream scenario. So let's go for it.
Yeah.
And this is what it takes, that, that the studio really sees something in that. And this is, we were so lucky to have Paramount believing in us.
Yeah.
Otherwise, nothing of this bus, I think, would have happened, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my God. That's so exciting, dude. Okay. So then it gets the buzz. You get into these, the film gets into Oscar prediction lists from Variety. It gets into Oscar prediction lists from Hollywood Reporter, yeah, major entertainment outlets. That's crazy already. And then, so where does it start where you're brought in with Tim and with the producers to go to LA? What's the first premiere? What's the order of things there?
The movie after Telluride, there was the Zurich Film Festival, and
right,
then from then on, Paramount sent it to a lot of U.S. festivals. Mm-hmm. I think there were Austin, Denver, Palm Springs, like a lot of those festivals, and already scheduling like screenings in LA and New York for like, I think they call it tastemaker screenings, or like screenings to show it to the industry, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And this is where they started scheduling us, like obviously Tim and the cast, because they're like the first row, like the faces of the project, and they had to do a lot of Q&As, a lot of interviews, a lot of screenings to get like the industry and the broader audience to get to know about the movie and see it. And it's very interesting that it's still all about getting people to watch the movie, to talk about it. This mm-hmm. is what I really love, because it's not, okay, we are putting out like a social media campaign and with
right.
It's more like really getting people into a theater, sitting down, watching the movie for 90 minutes, letting the movie speak for itself.
Yeah.
This is what I really love.
Yeah.
And this is what they actually do, like showing the movie to people and saying, I think we have a good movie. What do you say?
Yeah.
And so this cool. is what happened the last weeks when Thomas and Philip, the producers, and Julian Wagner, the production designer, Lorenz Dangel, the composer, Hans-Jörg Weisberg, the editor, me, you know, we all went there to LA to show yeah. the movie. I mean, that was, and Markus Förder, obviously the DP, is already living in LA, so he was there too. We all sat down with the people, like two or three screenings a day, answering their questions, talking to reporters about our work. And it's such a great feeling, because the industry in the US is so, it really appreciates movies.
Yeah.
It really is. There is such a big industry and there is such a big interest in movies.
Yeah.
That the screenings were always full. The reporters were always super prepared, super interested, and they're like big outlets, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, that's an unbelievable journey and such an honor to be like part of it.
Yeah. And then, I mean, and the perks of it too, like, you know, that kid, going back to that kid's dream thing.
Yeah.
Going there, you're you know, being hosted by Paramount Pictures
yeah.
in LA, going to these events, like, of course, promote, like you were saying, promoting the film, letting it speak for itself, going there as the team,
yeah.
you know, with Peter, you met Sean Penn.
Yeah.
You know, so you're there with Peter and John McGarro and Leone Benish, Ben Chaplin.
Yeah.
And then, you know, what was like your first sort of, did you have like a star-stunned moment on the trip?
A lot. but for the first thing is that I was like the only time I've been to LA before was when I was 16. I was there with my dad. We did like a USA road trip thing. He always wanted to go to the national parks, the Grand Canyon, and I begged him, Dad, please, let's go to LA. He said, why do you want to go to a city? I mean, there's so many great landscapes. And no, please, I want to see where the movies are made. So we did like two days in LA. We did like Universal Studio tour.
Oh.
I visited the Paramount Studios.
And he saw your eyes like...
Yeah, yeah. He took a look at a lot of photos. And this is where I really decided, no, I have to go for that dream. I really have to become a filmmaker, a movie maker.
Yeah.
And then like... A lot of years later, decades later, I'm returning to LA having a movie there.
Dude, it's
this was so like full circle, mind blowing. That was crazy. And then the other full circle moment was that when I was like 18, already decided to become a filmmaker, I always listened to a Robbie Williams song that's called I Will Talk and Hollywood Will Listen. And that was like kind of a hymn to me for this like impossible dream.
Yeah.
Like maybe, who knows, one day. And then I wrote in my diary, I want to achieve three things. I want to get an Oscar. I want to make a movie with Harrison Ford, and I want to meet Robbie Williams. And now when I was in LA, Robbie Williams had a movie there too, and I met him at a Paramount party. And then that was full circle, because I was like there in this whole Oscar buzz meeting Robbie Williams. That was like a special moment to me. Yeah.
Is it not like that's insane on its own, but like how MFing close are you to having all three, dude?
No, well,
I mean, if you become an Oscar winner, which you're very much a contender, then you would have a chance of maybe having something with Harrison Ford before he dies.
Well, I think, let's see.
I mean,
don't jinx it. I would.
But two out of those three,
I would pass out if we are even getting nominated. Really, I would pass.
I have a lot of confidence in the nomination, especially for screenplay. It fits, like it just fits what the movie is kind of. Yeah, I have no doubts about that.
Here's wood. Let's knock yes. on wood. But yeah, let's see. The thing is, even if nothing happens, like with the nomination, this is beyond my wildest dream, because what I really wanted to do is write a feature film that's going to be shown in theaters. And this is what happens now. And yes. Everything that adds is like such a bonus, such a like an add-on that I would never have dreamed of.
Yeah.
So this is that actually was my mindset when I went to LA, to experience that for like a once in a lifetime experience, and being grateful for it. And this is what it feels like now. Let's see what happens from now. But if nothing happens, I'm super grateful already.
Yeah, dude. I mean, it's been such a cool run so far.
Yeah.
And I have to say the list out loud, because it's still even for me like so unbelievable. But Robbie Williams, Sean Penn, Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah.
Who was it? There was a. I mean, obviously the cast, but yeah. There was also someone else. I thought at one of these events, but still, like Jake Gyllenhaal on his own is like. What a
yeah he was I mean moment. I was just shaking his hand and talking to I think 2 minutes with him, but he's such a nice guy. He's so supportive. I mean, he did the introduction of our New York screening, and he obviously is the brother-in-law of Peter Sarsgaard, but he did it so, how you call it, I mean, he was so eager to get all our names pronounced right. He was so well prepared. He was so open. He supportive. He told us to enjoy the ride, and he really thinks we have something there and we might go a long way. And he was really
like just, genuine and supportive, yeah, and compassionate.
Yeah, that was,
it's everything you hope for.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
And like you were saying earlier before we started rolling, that he just has this incredible aura about him. Like
yeah.
He's just super ripped. Yeah. Like,
yeah. And no, he's, being. And yeah, he's standing there like, yeah. It's not like being starstruck. It's like being in the presence of somebody who has such an aura. And the thing is, that goes with a lot of actors and actresses, that when they enter a room, the mood in the room changes. And it's not because they have this big entrance. They just enter the room, but they have something. And I think this is what people sometimes can sense when watching them on the screen. It's like this something.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think they have that.
Yeah, he's someone who like plays the he can be so silly and goofy. Like on SNL or when he did this John Mulaney lunch brunch show, he plays the music man. Like he can be so insane and it really comes off very funny, but then immediately do something like Nocturnal Animals or Nightcrawler and you're like, this guy is so legit.
He's
a monster.
I think
he doesn't have an Oscar yet, does he?
I don't know.
I know he's been nominated, but he needs him and Peter need to get to winning.
Because I think he is, I mean, obviously he's super talented, but he's also so disciplined and he's the way he approaches characters and roles is like you mentioned Nightcrawler or Zodiac or Jarhead or I mean the way he approaches characters is like very well prepared and very there's a lot of hard work involved and
Totally dude he's an obsessive. I don't know you know it's like Denzel or something. That's the only thing he can do. I think because he's just like built for that. Okay, let me look here. I didn't want to get lost on it, but we talked about the story of the movie, how things got rolling. We talked about some funny stories from set that we will never mention again. No, I'm kidding. We talked about the machinery, the campaigning of it, the celebrities you got to meet, the Hollywood experience. Any final, before we send this off into your surprise, any final thoughts about the, well, I mean, you did put it so perfectly already about how happy you are if everything just stops here, but any final thoughts about where the next steps will go in terms of the international release, feelings about where you're like maybe who in your own life you're most excited to get the chance to see it, and any sort of final feelings about everything we've talked about?
Well, I think now I have like a sense of how people in the industry are liking the movie and watching the movie, and the response has been great, and with journalists as well. I mean, it's a journalistic story, so I think they're kind of biased in a good way, like because it's a movie about journalists and they really appreciate that. So the response from journalists were great, the responses from the industry were great, and now I'm really excited of how the audience will react. And I will sneak into a couple of showings. Now, what's it called?
Screenings.
Screenings. Yeah. I was sneaking in like an ordinary screenings because
we should go together.
Yeah, I would love that because I want to really feel the atmosphere in the room and the reactions when just like people who are putting like $10 on the table or $12 on the table for a ticket, like hard-earned money.
Yeah,
sitting in there watching the movie. I think that's the most direct and honest response you can get.
Yes,
and
then going to the bathroom and hearing the chit chat after.
Yeah, I would love to do that because this is in the end. This is why we are making movies. It's the audience, right?
Yeah,
and how they will feel about it.
Yeah. Dude, beautifully said. Okay, the long-awaited surprise. Let me see where we're at here.
Let me guess, it's your pants from the movie. It's the original.
I would love that. Imagine I never washed it. Just like,
and now so, I hand it to you.
this is your responsibility now. This is good. This is a nice jumbo episode today. Final thoughts here. Go watch September 5. I guess it comes out. What did the new change say about it?
No, in Germany it's January 9th, and in the US
December.
I think but 13th.
Because
that's
because on the main poster it still has like a wrong date.
Yeah, because it's let me just
but that
see.
Happens. Releases December 13th.
It
is here on IMDb.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so mom and dad, go watch September 5, December 13th. Get those box office numbers up. And for everyone else in Germany, you'll have to wait till January. So, haha. I got to see it and you'll have to wait. Okay, so with that in mind. So this is a long-awaited surprise. I hope it's I hope your hopes aren't too high. I hope it's as good as I've thought it would be. So the surprise is that you on set you had to leave before I did, and I was trying to think of something I could do to like make you smile, like, hey, I got to be on this cool project because of you. And so what I did was you had been gone and it was Peter Sarsgaard's last day. Mm-hmm. And I said that you are such a good friend of mine that you always listen to my podcast, and how cool of a surprise it would be if I could interview him. And I got about a 13 minute exclusive interview.
Really?
With Peter Sarsgaard, one-on-one, like very spontaneously, actually. Wow. I didn't think he'd say yes so easily.
That's crazy.
As a thank you to you, like, I'm gonna play it for you in real time, and for the listeners, I'll implement it into the show, so you can hear the quality the best possibility. But the funny thing about it, so I'll give you some heads up on it. I did not expect him to. I was so nervous to ask.
Yeah, sure, man.
He was talking to Zinedine.
Yeah.
He was talking to Zinedine. They were in. So they're in a parking lot in front of the door. So that lot area by the food trucks. They're both in like lawn chairs in costume. Mm-hmm. Peter has like the makeup napkin around his mm-hmm. shirt, and all I had was my phone.
Jordan, and I was like, super brave, man.
And I was like, dude, you know, he's been so kind. He's never brushed me away. Yeah, he was always, yeah. I talked to him about, he could tell I was a freak for him. Like I mentioned all these movies and he was so happy to talk about his career. Yeah. So I think that helped that he knew I was like such a geek for him. But I went up to him and I said it just like that. Like, hey, you know, I don't want to interrupt, but you know, and at this point calling him Peter, which even sounds strange now, I was like, you know, Peter Moritz, the writer of the movie, he and I are both such huge fans, and he listens to my podcast, and he's one of like just two people that just listen every week, and I know that he would freak out if, as like a gift to him, that I could maybe ask you a few questions like for the podcast. Dude, no hesitation, not even like how many listeners or like this has to go through.
No, he's not like that. He's like, super
dude,
nice.
He didn't even like sit up in the chair. Yeah. He's just like, yeah, sure. And yeah. I was like, oh, and I took out my phone and I didn't expect. Like,
yeah.
So
yeah.
I'll preface it with, I recorded it on my phone outside.
Yeah.
So I had to run the audio through an AI processor to clean it up. So it's very clean. It sounds like studio, but it also, just for the listeners like at home, sometimes it sounds a little weird. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's like you can hear the computer has had to like fix something. Because right behind him was a table of people chatting, mm-hmm. and I could not give them evil enough eyes. Like they just didn't see that I was like, please shut up. and you can tell him, first off, you can tell I'm super nervous the first couple of questions. I didn't really know what to ask at first. So it doesn't get running until about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But then his answers become long and he becomes like very comfortable. But the first 5 minutes, it's a little awkward and clunky, just so you know.
But how did you feel when you approached him or when you started the interview?
The first couple of things, I was working like double overtime to think of what to ask. Like, what's not a stupid question, you know?
And
like,
yeah.
How do I? So it starts off like very, very easy. Like, how did this script come across your desk? Mm-hmm, what did you think of it originally? Mm-hmm. You know, all this stuff. So it's pretty simple at first, and then it gets more in depth because he starts talking about like the future of cinema and like royalties and all these like more mm-hmm. Film industry stuff. And the coolest thing about it, and then I'll finally just play it, is that the only reason it stops at like 13-ish minutes is because I was needed on set. Isn't that funny?
That's super funny.
I was sitting at his feet. I was seated. So the thing is, he's holding my phone on his chest like this.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting on the pavement at his feet. And I'm, so you can hear me ask, but maybe I'll clarify if anything sounds too rough. But I'm sitting at the floor like, so how did the script come across your desk? You know? And then, I had to take it through AI to clean up all the background noise. So sometimes it sounds a little weird and I'm very nervous at first, so forgive me. But without further ado, after nearly 2 years of waiting to show you this, here is my exclusive interview with Peter Sarsgaard. So yeah,
ask me a question. So how did you come across the script for this movie?
Oh, the usual way, through my agents. I mean, you know, they have decent taste, it turns out.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And what made you decide to accept the role?
You know, that's always just kind of intuition, isn't it? It's just sort of like, I felt like I could play it. It's very hard to describe because sometimes my agents will give me something that they think I'll like, and I think I'll like by the description of it, and I'll read it and I'll even like it. But, you know, there's that. And there's also like that it fits in with your life, right? Like it makes sense. Like when I first accepted this, I wasn't doing anything else during this time also.
So it's like a perfect
time. So it's like a perfect time situation. Of course, now I accepted something else and it got all fucked up, but...
It's also not so bad, right? Having too many jobs at the same time.
I don't like having too many. I like doing at the most 3 things a year.
3K, that makes sense.
Yeah, and that's like at the most, you know, especially if I'm on it the whole time.
Do you feel like you're at a point now where you could turn down things for a few years if you wanted to?
Depends on if my wife works. There's the idea that it's work and you have to make a living doing it also and pay for all the things you have to pay for. And you don't want to put yourself in a corner where you don't work for many years, several years, and financially you need to work and then you have to accept something that is not something you would normally do, which I've done before. But if you kind of stay ahead and have a little financial cushion and creative cushion, I would even say, then you're able to be more intuitive and about selecting things instead of like thinking, I got to pay for college for my kid.
Did they originally offer you Rune, or was that a character that you wanted to?
No, they offered me Rune. Yeah.
And what did you like about Rune as a character?
I like playing people that are in charge. It's fun.
He's got such an authority in the room, right?
I like playing people that are... I've done both, but... You know, like, I think of, like, military movies, right? It's more fun to be, for me, to be the sergeant than to be the grunt.
Why is that, you think?
Don't have to crawl through the mud and do all that shit.
You can stand back with the binoculars, like,
totally. Yeah, absolutely. And people are looking to you to make decisions. And, yeah, it's... Maybe when I was younger, I would have liked the other thing more. Not sure, though. But I like characters that are, you know, have an equal balance between mind and heart, or at least some combination of both, you know?
Hey guys, this is Jordan from the future here editing, just to let you know that, again, apologies for how bad the audio can be sometimes. It's a phone recording, and I'm mixing together the enhanced version, which sometimes picks up, like, wind and background voice and tries to make it clear, and it comes off kind of muddled. And I'm mixing that with the original audio, which, of course, puts all that wind and background audio into the forefront. Makes it kind of hard to hear. But the next question basically asks, at this stage of his career, because he's had so much success, I ask, does he prefer smaller budgeted films or bigger budgeted films? Like, does he prefer the small budget indie films, which are the films that I've known and grown to love him for? Or does he prefer stepping onto these bigger like enormous budget projects, which he's also done, like the recent Apple TV Plus show. Anyway, back to it.
At this stage in your career, because you've had so much success, prefer smaller budget projects like this?
I don't have a preference, really. I mean, I don't like things that are too slow.
Yeah.
So if the movie's really big and it takes months and months and you shoot half a page a day, I don't like that very much. But if it's good enough, I do it anyway, you know? And then, of course, if the thing is very small, then you're shooting 15 pages a day, and that's very difficult quality-wise to keep up with. So, you know, there's a balance in there somewhere. I would say, ideally, so now you would make $15 million movies and have the right amount of time to make adult films, but that mid-range doesn't really exist like it used to. I heard Matt Damon talking about this recently.
On Hot Ones? About the DVD?
Series. Yeah, yeah. I totally agree with him.
Yeah.
I think that is...
This is another wave coming. It's a completely different business.
Yeah.
Do you feel almost threatened by the streaming world now? As it is?
I would if I were younger.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, I feel like I made it over the hump. And
yeah, you were grandfathered. Yeah. Perfect generation.
Yeah, I got lucky. If for anyone starting now, I would actually tell them to look at like micro budget type stuff.
Micro budget.
Like really, I don't even know that much about it, but I know that movies can be made for $100,000. And I mean, all the equipment is available. You just have to learn the tech aspect of it, which I'm not very good at, but like, I don't know, you got to find a friend that, or do it yourself, that, you know, when you can go and rent all the cameras and, you know, rent time at the editing suite. But if you don't know how to use the shit, then you're fucked. And I guess you don't have to even rent time at the editing suite. If you have access to a computer and, you know, get some programs, you can put a movie together. My daughter, who's not going to be an actress or hasn't expressed interest yet in being an actress anyway, her friend made a film that she acted in. It's a short film, and it screened at Toronto Film Festival. And the whole thing was made for very little. I would say $5,000.
I mean, do you think it's, despite, like you said, for a younger actor, you'd feel threatened by the streaming world, but do you think it's also that more advantageous that...
It's more work.
They can make things, yeah, there's more work, and they can make things themselves for YouTube or...
Yeah, I guess it depends on what you're... You know, I was always a real cinephile growing up. And so it's very old-fashioned, right? Like, I wanted really to make things that went to movie theaters, that had artistic ambitions, that wouldn't fit on the average streaming platform because of their length and content. And I still manage to do them occasionally, but, you know, obviously all the money is in television. And even places like Netflix, you know, are making movies that will be in theaters, but mostly be watched on streaming, which is the place where that sort of $15 million adult film lives now. You know, like Matt Damon was talking about the DVDs, where the actor doesn't get any cut, usually, of, right, like people watching it on Netflix, right? Like you get paid your salary. And then it streams on Netflix. So, yeah, I mean, it, obviously, actors used to participate more in the back end when a movie played in theaters and it reached a certain number, and then you'd get a bump and your raise and all that pay and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Do that a lot less now for cinema films?
Oh, yeah. Now they do like buyouts and stuff. So if you're doing a movie that's going to be streaming mostly, but play in theaters a little bit, they pay the actors who are of like very famous big money actors extra. It's a little buyout. It means like, we know you're not going to make your usual extra little bit if it does well, so we're going to go ahead and upfront pay you more. But that's only if they're trying to get compete with Warner Brothers, that would only show in theaters, and try to get the actors that would normally be in those to be on some of the streaming services.
Would you say you have a consistent pet peeve with the acting industry, with the film? Is something that you wish would change? Something that bothers you in general?
Yeah, there's a lot of wasted money. And there's a lot of wasted money and a lot of wasted energy. And, you know, when you hear about all this, all the climate reports that came out the other day and everything, you just think, like, I know, I would actually say here in Germany it's better, but the amount of waste and time and travel and all that sort of stuff is pretty ridiculous. So I would love to see the industry clean itself up a little bit.
No, that makes sense. Is there an innovation recently, for example, the way they use the backdrops in Mandalorian, something that interests you when you see new tech and what it could do? Or does that not interest you as much because you're a purist, for example?
I mean, I wouldn't say I'm a purist. I just don't know that much about that stuff. Sound has always interested me, you know. But that's not a department that has advanced as much as some of the others, you know what I mean? And I'm always interested in good sound.
And have there been any films?
Because I've done films with bad sound.
Yeah. I mean, would you say what?
No, but I've had to ADR portions of movies. It depends on the director, really. Like, some people are perfectly happy with sound that is not, like, perfect. If they want it perfect,
As someone who's so interested in sound, what do you think about how Chris Nolan does it in Tenet, where you almost understand nobody?
Yeah, I like that.
You liked it? Did you feel like when you watched it that you got it? Or that you liked
it? I just watched it. I didn't think of it. I like him, though. To me, he's like a real innovator. He's pretty badass.
Next, I ask, are there some directors you'd love to work with but haven't yet?
Yeah, but many of them are kind of older now. I mean, I'm mostly looking for working with young talent, you know.
Anybody?
Like new people. I really like this director I worked with last year named Michelle Franco.
Michelle Franco?
Yeah, he Mexican director, who's directed maybe 6 films, art films. He shoots things in a one-er.
Oh, that's
every cool. Scene is basically a one-er with no coverage. And he has a whole system for the way that he shoots that's very actor-focused. I mean, it's obviously, if you're not moving the camera around, it's all on the actors.
When you're shooting TV or film, what brings you the most pressure? Where do you get the most anxiety?
It's just other people's anxiety.
Other people?
Yeah.
Energy feeder?
Yeah, like I'm working with either another actor or director or even producer, or yeah, it could be someone from any department who's filled with anxiety and their own pressure for whatever reason. I tend to pick it up. I have to fight. Spend a lot of time fighting, acquiring their energy.
What do you think is the most difficult thing between television, like procedurals, and I've done some of those before, or Broadway or film, like big box office movies?
For me, it's all very similar.
Yeah,
you know, I treat everything the same. I don't really.
You strike me as a guy who just shows up and does his job, like
totally.
Not overthinking the.
No, I read the script usually several times. I get to know my fellow actors. I try to create an environment on set where I feel creative and comfortable and other people around me do. And then I don't overthink it. I just do it. And I feel like a lot of times I intuitively know. I always say my job is like I'm the canary in the coal mine. Everyone was like, oh, it looks like it's going great. And I'm like, nope, there's not enough oxygen down here. you know, and I feel like in terms of the micro, I'm the leader. And then in terms of the macro, the director is the leader. And I just report back to him. I go, this is a dead end. And they have to trust me that it is. Because sometimes they'll be like, oh, no, from up here, it looks fine. I'm like, I'm down in it. And I'm telling you, can't say this line.
Okay. I have noticed on set here. I mean, I'd never worked with you before, so I wasn't sure what your methods are on set. But I was interested to see so many suggestions for line changes or for blocking.
Well, depends on the situation. I mean, in this situation, yeah. I speak English. Yeah, and I speak English better than anyone, including everyone who's creatively involved.
Totally.
So, sometimes I just go, like, no, this just has, like, another meaning that you're not hearing, and I can't say that. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, especially a lot of times things that would where you would have to dumb down the person you're playing in order to do it, unless the person's meant to be dull. I was a writer before I was an actor, so you know.
Oh shit. Well, thank you very much, Peter. Appreciate that.
Yeah, so we just put the recording back on here. I am torn. I don't know if the version you guys will hear will be a mixture of the original sound and the corrected sound. Because the issues I have with it are that in some parts of the original sound, the wind is just so pounding, you can't hear anything. And then in the enhanced version, sometimes the AI makes like weird mouth sounds that aren't there because it picks up the guy right behind Peter who's so loud, or it picks up the walkie-talkies. It was a very difficult interview situation.
And but, very spontaneous, right?
Extremely. I mean, I had to just find, like, I didn't really expect him to say yes, and I didn't really have anything prepared. I just, those first 3 or 4 questions was all I had. Like, how did you find the movie? How did you like the script? What do you think about your character? And then from then on, I just went off of whatever he said. I just went off whatever he said. If he talked about something with a process or something with the business,
yeah,
you can hear me. Like, I wish I would have shut up more.
But I think you can tell that he treated you like a colleague. I think he thought that you are like an actor asking him as an actor. It seems like
I lied pretty well. No,
no, no, no, no. But I think really that he respected you as a colleague.
I felt very respected by him. Like, what a gracious thing for someone of his stature to do. To no hesitation. Like, he took his time answering questions.
Yeah.
I have this one funny thing that I realized that he never says yes or no. Uh-huh. He always says, it depends on the situation. Which, you know, maybe it does, but it's so funny that I remember asking something where I thought, like, this will be a nice, clean soundbite. You know, it'll be like, oh, I never, you know, maybe sometimes he says, oh, I never do that, or I don't like this. But almost every answer I would be like, so when you're saying this, does that mean that you feel this way in this situation? Expecting him to be like, oh, definitely. But he would almost always go, you know, I don't think of it that way. It depends on the situation. But how gracious, man. How gracious of that. And and the most frustrating thing about it is the very, very end. You can hear, I don't know if the version you guys will hear on this, the one that we just heard in the studio together. You can hear them like... off like just in the background, like, Jordan, we need you. I guess that was early.
Yeah.
And then I remember like one of the PAs had to come up and like tap me on the shoulder, like, Jordan, oh, I'm needed. Oh shit. Okay. Oh, thank you, Peter, very much. And I had to like grab the phone off of his chest and like run. Ugh. But he would have kept going. Like, you know, he had a good flow. I think the whole thing was like, 13 minutes and some change.
Yeah.
Give or take. And he probably would have just done a half hour, like just sitting there.
I think so too.
And I think if I'd had more time, I would have gotten calmer and I would have been able to maybe wrap things up in a nicer way. But at least we got to hear the answer to that last question
before they
stopped us. But yeah, man, I've held in the secret of having, because also this will be great. You know, like now it kind of benefits Constantine a little bit that I got to see the movie because I actually have an interview with one of the stars and the writer.
That's great.
But yeah, man, it was very hard to not tell you that I had that. I mean, not that it's like some groundbreaking thing where we just talk about.
No, but I can imagine. Yeah.
I was like, but I talked to him and I want to, you know, it's just like, and I, yeah. Anyway, I hope that was as nice of a like surprise
totally.
As I thought it would be. But yeah, I hope you enjoyed it and I'm very excited for this movie. And thank you everyone so much for listening. This was a big jumbo episode, so I hope you guys had fun and enjoyed that. I know I've been taking some time off recently, so hopefully this is like enough of a payback. And
I noticed that too, Jordan.
Oh,
that you skipped a couple of weeks.
I didn't even assume. Like my assumption was that you would be so busy you wouldn't catch it.
No, every Thursday I'm looking at my phone. If there's no new episode, I'm getting a little bit grumpy. So, no, just kidding.
No, yeah. I mean, I think I missed 3 unannounced weeks, which is very, that's never happened since I started the show. But it was just too much with the tour and, you know, starting a book. I don't know if I told you about that. And, of course, the hot sauce. So,
yeah.
A lot of new stuff coming out, and I couldn't do it all together. But, last things. Go see September 5 once again comes out December 13th in the States. And wait, that's not this. Oh, sorry. December 13th and in January in Germany. And good luck with all of these campaigns. And I know it's exhausting, but very exciting.
Thanks.
All these premieres. And knock on wood that we get that, at least that nomination, man. Just one of it. Just come on, you know. It's so good. Go see it, box office weekend. And like I said at the beginning of the episode, yes, the Ausfahrt to Hell, Jordan Prince original hot sauce, it should be available. It will be. It's releasing the day before this comes out. It's got a great ingredient list. If you like chipotle, jalapeno, tomato, onion, garlic, a little vinegary, oniony. I love this flavor. I have put it on literally everything. It's not too hot. It's for the spice heads, it's got enough heat where you'll be happy. And for the average consumer, it's got a great flavor and it's not going to overdo it. We really tried to find the perfect balance of heat and flavor. So yeah, thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you so much, Moritz, for doing this. I know that...
Thanks for having me, Jordan.
I know talking in long stretches in English, you were a little concerned about it, but I think...
yes.
You may not accept that flattery, but you really... your English is really a lot smoother after this big 10-day trip.
Thank you.
But practice makes perfect, man. But yeah, go watch the movie, go eat some hot sauce, and thank you, buddy. I love you.
Love you too.
Look out, baby. The saints are coming through. And it's all over now.